Force.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 27. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. Our guest this episode is Tommy Giles Rogers, frontman of the band Between the Buried and Me. He is both the vocalist and keyboardist of the progressive metal band and an accomplished solo artist. Extremely versatile, very prolific, and an all-around sweet guy. BT BAM, as they are sometimes abbreviated, actually covered Blackened on their covers record, which was released back in 2006. As always, I would like to ask you if you would be so kind. Open up your Apple Podcast app and leave a 5-star rating and a nice little review for Speak and Destroy, because that stuff matters. So here it is, my conversation with Tommy Giles Rogers of Between the Buried and Me. This is Speak and Destroy.
Metallica.
Are you familiar with the band Metallica? Have you
heard? I've heard of Metallica. Yeah. This is awesome because I actually I got to go back and kind of listen. You know, they're not. I love Metallica, but they're not the band I go to all the time to listen to. So it was nice, you know, this past week to be like, I'm gonna throw on Master Puppets and all that stuff. So,
well, I think for some people, you know, they're just such a part of the fabric of our experience,
yeah,
and the music landscape that even if you're not regularly listening, it's sort of like, you know, I don't throw on The Godfather 2 to go to sleep, but
yeah,
you know,
it's a part of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's start early days. What were kind of some of your first, and not specific to Metallica, but just in general, kind of your first musical moments? Did you have, people in your family that were into music, that were musicians? Did you hear stuff around the house? What was your kind of early point of discovery?
My family wasn't that musical. But my dad always listened to the radio, you know, classic rock radio. So I was exposed, you know, very early on to that world, which I just kind of heard throughout my whole life. And now that's some of my favorite music, which is kind of cool. But, I don't know. I was really instantly drawn to 80s metal. That was like my first, I mean, I don't even know what turned me on to it. I assume it was MTV, you know. You know, my sister and I religiously watched Headbangers Ball. And that's how I found out about music, really, was magazines, that, and then, you know, the random, like, rock and roll shop in your town, you know, which those existed back then. You would talk to the employees and learn about music. But yeah, my sister and I were really in that world, and it was so rad because my mom was so supportive and she took us to all the shows, you know, so all those bands we got to see for the most part. And, I mean, I guess Motley Crue was my first, you know, I remember getting, you know, their first cassette and that was really that, you know, from then on, it was just kind of how I am now. I'm constantly trying to discover something new and new bands, and it just kind of evolved. And I think any young kid, you know, I was probably, you know, pretty young, like 7, 8 when I got into that stuff. And, you know, you naturally kind of progress into more aggressive. And, you know, that's when Metallica came in the picture. I was like, okay, you know, I grew up with, you know, I love Motley Crue. I love all, you know, Skid Row, all that stuff, but this band's got some edge to it. They're not wearing makeup. They're, you know, they look like dudes that, you know, skate and start fights, and it was cool, you know. And that was right when I was starting to take interest in playing guitar. And, you know, this past week when I've kind of listened to a lot of the old stuff, I really realized how important Metallica was for my guitar playing. You know, I basically learned guitar through Metallica, which is kind of crazy to think about, but, you know, all these songs, that's what I wanted to learn, you know, and that's what I learned. And my technique, you know, through good and bad, was because of Metallica.
Well, Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, you know, you often hear some of the hard rock bands, particularly from that era, referred to as gateway bands, you know, where
yeah,
it's like...
exactly, yeah.
That takes you further and further. And one of the things that I've always celebrated about Metallica and comes up a lot on this podcast is how much they celebrate their musical DNA. You know,
yeah.
And it's... I mean, the fact that, you know, their first couple of shows, I think there were almost as many Diamond Head songs as there were, you know, I think there were more Diamond Head songs than
yeah.
Metallica songs. And it's like they, you know, they've always lifted up, you know, whether it's the Misfits or Motorhead or, you know, they've been very, not just unapologetic, but almost aggressive about putting out there.
Yeah,
what
and,
they
and
love,
that was
you know?
So cool. I mean, I didn't really notice a lot of that. You know, at a young age, but now as I'm older, I mean, it's really cool how they weren't embarrassed. Cause I mean, back then, like punk and metal, it was, you know, pretty segregated, and it's cool to see like these dudes, they were like, we fucking love punk and it's part of our DNA and, you know, all these other bands. Yeah. And they were those bands' biggest promoters, which is cool. Because that just shows you they love music. I mean,
yeah.
And I don't know. As a musician, that I can totally relate to that. I think that's really, really, really cool.
What record were they on when you discovered them, and what was your?
I was trying to think of that. I mean, the only record, because I wasn't super young. The only record I like remember release date and going to buy the tape was the Black Album. So it was somewhere between when Justice came out and Black Album.
Yeah, that's a good sweet spot in there. Yeah, for me it was just a little bit earlier. They were the Garage Days EP was the current release, mm-hmm. and Justice was the record that I remember going to get on the street date.
Yeah.
So not too far apart.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny, the day that we're recording this episode, just pure happenstance happens to be the anniversary of the tragic death of Cliff Burton in 1986. And yeah, I believe I discovered the band in 1987. So it was kind of like, you know, right after that chapter had closed and a new chapter had opened for them. It's interesting talking about And Justice for All and talking about bass players, because obviously one of Jason Newsted's big contributions to Metallica is that riff in Blackened.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Between the Buried and Me, you know, gosh, I guess 10 years ago now.
God, yeah, that's crazy.
you guys did a cover of Blackened.
Yeah.
Why that song?
I don't know. There wasn't much discussion. I think, you know, for most of those songs, that record was pretty rushed in general. You know, we kind of just each sent like our top, you know, few songs that were like, oh, this would be cool. And that was the one that kept coming up. I don't know. I think it was – it really showed what we love about Metallica, just, you know, the thrash element, you know, the real fast part of Metallica, yet the really melodic metal riffs that they wrote, because they were so good, especially back then with the – you know, even though it was super melodic and beautiful – it was still aggressive, you know, and I think that song definitely captured that. And we just wanted to do kind of an in-your-face Metallica. I think looking back, you know, where the band has come, I'm surprised we didn't pick one that was more, you know, has clean stuff and heavy stuff, you know, some of those songs they had. But I'm glad we did what we did.
Yeah, and I love that it's the first track on your cover record, just like it's the first track on Injustice.
Yeah, I think once we recorded it, and I remember that was fun kind of figuring out how they did that intro. And we're like, God, this is just so cool. We need to, you know, it's such a big part of our lives is that intro to that album. I mean, it's such an important album. And so, yeah, it felt right.
Yeah, and I believe live, that intro, you know, they do it as like an intro tape.
Oh, like
they
cool.
don't recreate that live.
it's a reversed part, which, you know, at that point of recording, we didn't know what we know now. And God, it was so cool being like, how'd they achieve that? And we're like, I think, you know, we had to flip you know, flip their version, you know, reverse and learn it. And it's like, okay, so it's just this part reversed. It was simple, but it's just such a cool, you know, as everyone knows, it's such a cool sounding intro.
Yeah, that first single from Danzig 4, Can't Speak,
mm-hmm.
that was another song on the record, Let It Be Captured, the main riff of that played backwards.
Oh, cool.
and then that became like the whole, you know, anchor to Let It Be Captured, to Can't Speak, which was then like the biggest song off of that record. So
yeah,
that's I love awesome. Stuff like that. And I've been, I'm a huge fan of the 1986 box office bomb Trick or Treat. And that movie, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the...
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're about to go on the road, so you have no excuse not to watch it. It's, I'm gonna divert us into Trick or Treat. I think Metallica podcast listeners will either be stoked on this or should be educated about it. So Trick or Treat was a movie, came out in 1986, and it was a couple of guys who were producers on Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Another big producer, God, such serendipity that I didn't even realize. This movie was financed and shot in North Carolina.
Oh, really? Crazy.
Yeah. Much like my favorite movie of all time, The Crow. It's also in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a great movie.
So
I'm looking at this right now. It looks pretty awesome.
Oh, dude. Yeah. So basically, it was a combination of factors where, this big producer said, I want my own Freddy Krueger. I want like a horror franchise with like a supernatural, you know, killer or whatever. And these two Freddy's Revenge, producers met with a writer who was a first time writer, never had anything made, who pitched this idea of a heavy metal rocker comes back from the dead via a backwards message on a record.
That's awesome.
And
especially in that time when, you know, all those, you know, trials were going on about that.
Yeah, there's even a scene with the rocker, Sammy Kerr, the rocker of the film, like a PMRC style hearing.
That's awesome. It's Gene Simmons is
Gene Simmons and Ozzy Osbourne both have cameos in it.
That's great.
Initially, they approached Gene Simmons about playing Sammy Kerr, mm-hmm. and he said, "No, I'd rather play this local DJ character that's in it." And it's, you know, it's probably a couple days' work for him. He's not in the movie very much. And Ozzy plays an evangelical, like televangelist preacher who's anti-heavy metal.
That's awesome.
and I'm a big nerd about that movie, and I was just reading recently actually that they didn't write dialogue for Ozzy because he didn't have acting experience. They just let him riff. So it's all everything he says in the movie is improvised, and it's he's great. He's hilarious, and it's a cameo, you know, but it's a great cameo. But yeah, essentially, you know, the writer for the movie was kind of writing the main character. Eddie Weinbauer was very autobiographical. And it was basically, you know, he's this high school kid in North Carolina who's picked on by all the jocks and the bullies. He's this, like, heavy metal nerd. And Sammy Kerr is his idol. And Sammy Kerr dies kind of early in the movie. And Sammy Kerr is from his hometown. There's that tie also. And Sammy Kerr was, you know, bullied and everything as a kid. And left North Carolina and became this big famous rock star and everything. So yeah, Gene Simmons, the local DJ and friend of Sammy Kerr, gives Eddie, the main character, what do they call it? An acetate, the like studio demo vinyl from back in the day, of Sammy Kerr's final unreleased album that, he's going to be playing on the radio at midnight on Halloween. And yeah, Eddie takes that record home and discovers there's backwards messages on there and basically summons Sammy Kerr back from the dead. And Sammy Kerr proceeds to start murdering the high school bullies. And
I mean, that's a great storyline.
Right. And and it was a flop. And it's definitely taken on like a cult.
Yeah.
You know, and the main actor in the movie, Mark Price, played Skippy, the next door neighbor, on Family Ties.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, you know, Michael J. Fox is going from Family Ties into making these big movies. And I mean, it was the year after Back to the Future.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, oh yeah, now it's Skippy's turn. Here's Skippy's big movie vehicle. And then it was kind of like, you know.
And nobody cared.
That was kind of it.
Well, I'm sold. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, dude. And there's a lot of, you may even be familiar with some of the locations because it was all shot there. You know, some of it's sets on a soundstage there. But there were two different high schools that both played, quote unquote, the fictitious high school in the movie. And yeah, you may even put it on and be like, oh, I know that street. Or
it's crazy.
Whatever. Yeah, so backwards messaging, that's how we got on that tangent. It's a podcast. It's tangents galore.
Hey, it's totally fine.
So do you remember then, you know, as an avid watcher of Headbangers Ball and being in that sort of mid-period pre-Black album, did you see the One video on MTV?
Oh, yeah.
Was that kind of was that the entry point, or do you remember what your first
I don't know, cuz I remember I had I mean, I think it was the earlier stuff, like Ride the Lightning, Kill 'Em All. Because I remember, I have a bad memory, by the way, but I do remember my friend and I listening to Kill 'Em All, and I would, for some reason, I would overdub the guitar solos with my mouth. I wish I had it. And, you know, I would ruin the tape. And, we would just sit there and be like, that whole thing. But I remember doing that. I can't remember the entry point, man.
But I remember learning to translate notes by doing that.
That's what gave me my ear. But yeah, I remember the older albums. So someone must have, you know, I kind of grew up playing with, I met this band called The Beast that kind of, I learned how to play guitar through their guitarist, and they were just a small band in North Carolina that became friends with my mom and my sister and I. And I assume that's how I found out about them, because they were like my entry into music in general, like all the 80s metal stuff, you know, between them and Headbangers Ball and all that stuff. But yeah, I wish I had like a entry point story, but I can't remember it, if there is one.
What stands out to you about thinking back about kind of teaching yourself guitar and learning a lot of those Metallica songs?
Well, one thing that kind of bit me in the ass later was I always read that Hetfield downpicked everything, and you know, they're very notorious for their fast chugging riffs. So I would, you know, I have a pretty fast right hand because of that. But later on, you know, riding with Paul, you know, in the early days of Between the Bear to Me, there was riffs I couldn't play because I was trying to literally downpick everything. And I had to kind of relearn how to alternate pick, you know, slower stuff. And it kind of messed me up for a little bit. But it was because, you know, I just read that Hetfield downpicked everything. And, you know, it's pretty funny thinking about that. Like everything I learned was, that was all I really wanted to learn was Metallica songs. You know, when I first picked up a guitar, there was a few like crew songs that I learned, but you know, Metallica was like the Bible for guitarists at my age at that point, you know.
Yeah.
And I was never really formally taught. So, you know, I would get the magazines that had the tablature in it, or the, you know, I think I even bought a few of the books back when they had those, you know, at the local music shops. And
yeah,
I loved playing along as best as I could to those records. And, you know, to this day, you know, some of the guitar work on those albums are just phenomenal. And I'm not the best guitarist, but it definitely taught me a lot. And I think a lot of my style, my writing style, that people may or not know, you know, stuff I write, but you know, Metallica's in there some way or another, especially with heavy stuff. So I look back and I'm really appreciative of that era, of what they did and how I learned it, you know?
Yeah. That right hand of James Hetfield, you know, him and Dave Mustaine, their mm-hmm. particular style of guitar playing that they were, and obviously, you know, they had AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and
yeah,
Aerosmith.
I just wouldn't really, you know, I'd heard that stuff through, you know, classic rock radio, but that stuff, I don't know. I was so close-minded then anyway. It wasn't heavy enough for me. So, you know, Metallica was it. And
yeah. And there's, you know, something about the way those guys translated those influences that spoke to people like you and I.
Yeah.
That their predecessors hadn't connected with us yet.
Yeah. And it's cool to hear now. I mean, because a lot of that stuff I didn't pick up on ever back then.
Yeah. Me neither.
And to listen now, you totally, you know, even this last week, I would pick up things like that. I'm like, God, it's just cool to hear. And, you know, Megadeth also, you know, they were in that world with me. I wasn't good enough. You know, like, yeah,
this, the world's like, state of the art speed metal band.
No offense to, you know, Metallica, but like Hangar 18 and, you know, anything Rust in Peace. I was just like, I want to play this stuff, but it's so, you know, Marty Friedman is just, that's some next level stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, and then you had, you know, prior to that, you know, Gar Samuelson and Chris Poland, who were literally jazz guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who were like, okay, it's the guy from Metallica and then these jazz guys doing speed metal. Yeah.
I know. Which it worked, man. Although, you know, those records are phenomenal as well.
Do you remember your first Metallica gig?
Dude, I've never seen Metallica play.
Wow. Well, we got to change that.
I know. Well, I was supposed to see them. I forget what tour. It was probably Black Album tour. It was when they had to cancel. I remember that. I can't remember if it was when the pyro thing happened with James.
Yeah, that was the Metallica tour.
It must have been. I don't know. I just remembered I was supposed to go. For some reason, it didn't happen, and then they canceled. So I wasn't that distraught because of that. But that was the only opportunity, which was weird because I've seen all the bands in that era. Like, they're the one, and not to be like the old, you know, jaded dickhead, but now I'm like, they're like old dudes now. I missed it.
Yeah, but they're still, they're bringing it on like a U2 level these days.
That's what I hear. I mean, the you know, regardless of your opinion of their later material, I hear they're just phenomenal live. And I think that's a beautiful thing about music in general. It's like, you know, I have a real problem with people, you know, bands that have a very long career like Metallica, they're going to change. They're going to go through life changes. They're going to change as people. So naturally their music is going to change. And for people to like not like the band anymore in general, it has always been ridiculous to me. Even, let's say, a band like Opeth, a lot of people are like, oh, they're not heavy. He doesn't scream anymore, so I don't like the band. But it's like, dude, those records still exist.
Yeah.
They're still gonna play those albums. They should still, you know, and Metallica's the same way. I don't celebrate their newer material, but I love those old records, and I would love to see them live. And I keep hearing they're phenomenal live.
It's an experience. I've had the opportunity to see them in recent years, you know, at the Rose Bowl, which is like as big as it can get, but then also, you know, I saw them do a charity gig at the Fonda in LA, which is like a, you know, 1300 cap room or something.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And I saw them at a Crackles Comedy Club in San Diego a few years ago. They did a show around Comic-Con, and that's another, like, you know, 1000 cap room or whatever. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah. It's a different experience, obviously.
It's impressive to see, you know, because I follow them in the sense of I go to news sites and I see things. It's very impressive to see their work ethic where they are now, just because they don't have to do it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's so cool to see them do all, you know, the smaller shows and tour as much as they tour. You know,
yeah,
they're not old, but you can tell they still love doing what they do, you know, which is...
And they put up every single show, soundboard recordings on
their
website. And they,
that's cool, man.
And the work ethic, yeah, I mean, they put out a music video for every song on the most recent record.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. That's
an
crazy.
Enormous press blitz. Like, they were everywhere press-wise. Like, yeah,
props,
like,
to them.
And like you said, they
don't
have to do that.
That sounds horrible.
Exactly.
I would hate to do that. That's cool, man.
Yeah, and they've created such a self-contained thing between their HQ, you know, in the Bay, their compound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they renegotiated their deal in the 90s at some point, and got all of their masters back a few years ago as a result.
Oh, really?
Of
that's
that.
Cool. Yeah.
And, yeah, so everything's, you know, Blackened Recordings. Speaking of Blackened.
Yeah.
So what was, I don't know, the most challenging, maybe, the most fun when you were kind of reverse engineering those Metallica songs and learning guitar? Does anything kind of stand out as like super hard to kind of push through, or?
Well, any of the melodic stuff, just because I didn't grow up playing anything like that. You know, I grew up just chugging away, you know, playing metal and all that. So any of the more, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, it sounds like talk. They're not ballads, but they're, you know, they have the 12 strings and, you know, the fade the blacks and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the first time that people said they sold out and they weren't good anymore.
Yeah,
before our time, you know, I was in elementary school.
Yeah, exactly. When, like, but I could see why, you know, those fans were like, oh, this isn't, you know, Metallica. We've all been through those phases in life where we're, you know, idiots in regards to that. But yeah, those songs for sure were the ones that, you know, I struggle with, but I'm glad I kind of sort of learned. I wouldn't say I learned to perfection by any means, but, you know, I, not even thinking about it, I kind of see those songs as kind of gateways into the more melodic side of, you know, where I've gone musically, you know, because now, you know, that's a big part of my life. So,
of course.
You know, I think just those melodies and, you know, how they arrange those songs, they're in my DNA, even if I don't notice it, I think, just because of how much I digested it. I mean, the thing about, you know, I'm sure it was the same with you, those records, you didn't have hundreds and hundreds of records, A, because you couldn't afford it, and B, you know, you didn't have the time because it's not like you're listening to it on your phone or something. So, I mean, you had your handful of records and you listened to them so much that you should have grown tired of them, but you didn't, you know? So I think all those albums are such a part of all of our DNAs because of how much we listen to them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's cool to think about that. Cause I mean, it's very rare that there's albums now that I listen to, you know, four times in a day. You know, I can't remember last time that's happened, but you know, that was what I did. You know, I'd sit in my room and just listen. So,
and
it's in there.
I love the point that you brought up about Opeth, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, Opeth, Metallica, Kiss, you know, for bands like that and their diehard fans, it's always such an exciting and vibrant and engaging conversation around the catalog. Like, I have mm-hmm. so much respect and admiration for bands that build a body of work that can be sort of debated, and, you know, and there's the records that you cherish above others for various reasons. And some of that is just time, place, and circumstance of your own life.
I think that's a huge part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the records that are kind of the black sheep. And then there's, like, you know, something that you love that nobody else does. And, you know, that came up in conversation, you know, a couple of nights ago when I had Ace at my Q&A series at Musicians Institute. Somebody asked a question about, or you know what? Actually, Ace brought it up. We started talking about The Elder, which was, like, you know, black sheep, Kiss concept album.
And, I'm not a Kiss fan. You know, I didn't really grow up with them. I was turned on to them because of Pantera. I was a huge Pantera fan.
Right.
But they were just, they weren't heavy enough for me. But I love The Elder.
There, like, you go.
it's but I wasn't exposed to much else. My wife Jessica, actually, she was like, have you not heard their concept record? I was just like, no, they had a concept record. I think it was when we were writing, you know, Coma, which was a big concept record.
I was just about to say it. I mean, it's not shocking that that's the Kiss record that you just covered.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, this is, I think it was because it's Kiss. I had no clue they had anything like that in them. And, you know, I have the record. I don't have any Kiss record, except I found that record. I was like, dude, this is awesome.
Yeah. And so, it's one of those moments where, you know, everything converged to make that record happen. And it's like,
and I'm sure the fans blight. Flipped out.
Yeah. I mean, fans hate it, but it was, but it was funny because Ace brought it up, that there's a lot about it that he likes.
That's awesome. Looking back. That's cool.
Yeah. And obviously Metallica is, I think, arguably the most kind of hotly contested and talked about and debated band of all, when it comes to heavier rock and metal. For that very reason, you know, there's, it's interesting, amongst Metallica fans where the various drop-offs are, you know, because, for example, people of a certain generation, you know, maybe the Black Album was the last album that they really loved. And for other people, it was Justice, and people look at Justice as a Holy Grail album.
Yep.
And I remember for me, you know, when I was a freshman in high school and I was a metal kid and I was, you know, a few months away from going from metal to hardcore and all that stuff. When Injustice for All came out, none of the metal kids liked it. It was like, ah, there's two good songs.
Yeah.
Dire's Even Blackened. The rest of it, it's boring and it doesn't sound good and it's too mechanical. And, you know, there were a lot of people that were like, once Cliff was gone, that was it. And so it's always interesting to me sort of, where people land on that map. For you, was it kind of post Black Album as you're moving into other stuff? And
yeah, Black Album was the last one for me. I still love that record.
It's a literally perfect album.
It's a phenomenal record. Yeah, I mean, I know some people don't, like you were saying, Justice was the last one, but yeah, the Black Album for me was the last one. From there, nothing interests me. You know, I thought a lot about it this week because I knew we were having this discussion. You know, I kind of look at it from a musician standpoint or someone that's been in a band for a long time. And, you know, it's like what I was talking about earlier. You know, I think they took a path that felt right to them. And I commend that. And I think, you know, I feel like those records, especially after the Black Album, they sound genuine. And I think at the end of the day, that's what makes a good band a good band, is if they're, you know, being genuine to the audience. And I think those albums are. But I also think that's what turns me off to even the later material, is that part of it to me sounds like they were trying to emulate old material for the sake of people that are like, I miss the old albums. I don't like, you know, this record or that record. But I don't know. I just think their work ethic, their, you know, how genuine it sounds, their risks. They took risks, which is commendable. You know, the Lou Reed thing, I didn't enjoy, but the fact that they did it is cool.
Same. Yeah. Exact same feeling about it.
You know, I they did that thing with the classical pianist guy with one. I mean, they did the full feature movie. I mean, it's cool that they have this drive to try new things in their world. Not everything is going to work. I mean, I think we've all been there, but they're kind of showing bands, you know, that you need to try it. And I think that's, you know, I appreciate that. And, you know, regardless of how I feel about certain records or how I connect with certain records, you know, I think it's impressive what they've done, regardless of, you know, opinions about actual music.
It's interesting the point you make about the later stuff, because I mean, you and I are certainly in agreement when it comes to the 90s, because oftentimes the criticism you would hear was, oh, they were chasing trends and playing Lollapalooza and cutting their hair and whatever. And I've always argued that whether you like that era or not, it was a continuation of Metallica's sort of, you know, against the grain, anti-trend sort of attitude. I mean, they knew that those were huge risks as much as anything else, you know.
Anybody that you have a fan base, you know, when you're kind of, you know, taking a dagger to them a little bit. I mean, I think anybody that writes music, you know when you're taking risks and you know you're going to get shit for it. And I mean, that's on a grand scale, like a huge, especially after the Black Album, which is, I mean, I don't know statistics, but it's got to be like one of the best selling heavy records ever.
Yeah. It is the biggest selling album of the SoundScan era.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah,
I mean, 16.5 million, I think.
I don't think people can,
in the US.
I don't think people can even grasp that kind of pressure, and for them to take the risks they took right after that moment is pretty, I mean, that's impressive, man.
Yeah, and it's interesting the point you made about the stuff sort of more recently. You know, when the new Star Wars movie started up again,
mm-hmm.
my review of the first J.J. Abrams movie, the headline was, "The Force Awakens is the death magnetic of Star Wars." And it's exactly for some of the reasons that you mentioned, where there's
yeah.
It's everything you wanted it to be, in the sense of like, oh, this feels like Star Wars again.
Yeah.
But it was also so, for me, it left me a bit cold because it was also so sort of intentionally, you know, fan service echoing.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a yeah. tough thing for me, especially with bands from that era that are still around. Because I mean, obviously you're trying to make a living. You're trying to cater to your diehard fans because you appreciate them. I don't know, but so, you know, like you said, with Death Magnetic, I'm listening to it. I'm like, okay, yeah, there's thrash beats. Yeah, it's aggressive. But if I'm sitting down to listen to Metallica, is this what I want to listen to? Or do I want to put on Injustice or something else? And that's what's tough for me, is like, that's the question I ask myself. Like, would I ever listen to this when it's time to have my Metallica moment? And no offense to anyone, but the answer is no. And I don't know if it's nostalgia with the old records, but I don't know. I feel like I like Death Magnetic more than like Load and those albums, but it doesn't sound as genuine to me.
No, I know. I think that's such an important point. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, clearly The Force Awakens is a better movie than any of the Star Wars prequels in the sense of being a film, you know, like
yeah.
The directing, the acting, the dialogue, the, you know, you name it. And yet I have a greater appreciation. I know this really upsets people. I have a greater appreciation for the prequels than I do The Force Awakens at this point. Because I recognize that authenticity and spirit in Lucas, that, you know, for me, art is always about intention, and yeah. that doesn't mean it's going to turn out awesome, or it doesn't mean I'm going to connect with it. And just as you said, I've always saluted the idea of the Lou Reed thing. I'm not a Lou mm-hmm. Reed fan. I'm not like a, you know,
yeah, same. Yeah.
Velvet Underground dude. My take, and I've said this on the podcast before, so I'll make it quick, but I always felt like doing it and taking the chance and getting together and, you know, after I met, I believe, at the Rock Hall, great, do it. But to me, it should have been one of those things that then gets put on a shelf.
Yeah.
And someday when, you know, the band's no longer making records or touring, or God forbid, you know, there's a significant lineup change or someone passes away and you start putting out those legacy releases, that's when you go, oh, by the way, one time Metallica did this weird like art album with Lou Reed that's based on like a German opera or whatever, you know, yeah. like, and then that comes out as this like curiosity, and yeah. I think it actually would have had a better chance of being
yeah.
received in that
yeah,
context.
That's a good point. That's yeah. a good point. I mean, the thing about stuff like that is, you know, I feel like that's one of those albums for them that they just had to do. It was something that came up. They're like, let's try it. I'm sure they knew at some point, you know, this isn't going to work for most people. But it's one of those deathbed records where, you know, they're going to be old at some point and they're going to look back and be like, I'm glad I did that. Regardless of success, regardless of, you know, the backlash we got from it. But I'm glad we did it because we needed to try that. And I think that's what it's all about, man. And it's cool to see that at the level they are, because I think they're in a great position creatively that they can, you know, they can't go too crazy with experimentation, but they can experiment in that sense and still be accepted for who they are because they're Metallica, because they're still playing shows and playing these albums and songs that people love, and they're playing them well. So yeah, it's just, I don't know. I had this small period where I had such a bad taste in my mouth with their later material, but now that I kind of really analyze it, it's, I back it, you know. I don't listen to it. I don't want to listen to it, but it's, I appreciate for their sake what they've done.
And it's always interesting to me talking with musicians, especially like yourself, who have had at this point a long career and have been able to sustain the business side of it, and have taken creative risks and taken your fans on an adventure and a journey. I think that it's always interesting that perspective that you gain, where you remember, you know, when you were a fan and when you were a kid, and bands you loved changed and evolved and did different things, and then suddenly you find yourself in that same position and you're like, oh, okay.
I mean even though it's such a different scale, it's all very similar. I mean, for me, you know, the time and place thing you brought up earlier is such a great point, because, you know, like we're talking about these early records, we were in this place where you're young, you're searching for new things, you know, and these records come out and they just change your life. And you know, for someone like me that's had a long career, you know, I meet these kids that, you know, they have these albums that are super dear to them, but I'm like, what? You know, you naturally like, well, what about our new stuff? You know, because the new stuff is what matters to me, because, you know, you put this time and energy and all this work into it.
And that, but and the then, new stuff is who you are now and what you have to say now. Exactly. And you're like, why are you so attached to who I was when I was 19 or what, you know?
Exactly. But when you step back and you think of yourself as a fan, you're like, oh, okay, they were probably going through some shit then, or it was at a time in their life where they hadn't heard a band like us, and we kind of helped them, we nudged them in a direction that maybe they are now, even musically where they are now. So you have to kind of, you know, time and place is a huge part in music. You know, either a record gets you through, you know, a moment in your life, or it steers you in a path, you know, musically, or you know, musically as far as your taste goes. But yeah, I think that's such a good point. And I think it's important for musicians to try, you know, think about that when you get in those moments where you're down on yourself and you're like, oh, we keep seeing all this shit online about, you know, how we don't sound like we used to, but that's a good thing. That means that you've evolved. You're not doing the same thing over and over. And these people, they've grown, they've changed. You know, it's anything over a 15, 20-year period, you know, a lot goes on in that time. And a lot of growing up and changes happen in people's lives. And, you know, Metallica experienced that on a grand, grand scale. And they're still experiencing that. But I'm sure that's cool for them to see all these generations and seeing it passed down, you know, from generation to generation, and seeing what still resonates with, you know, people of certain ages. And I'm sure it changes depending on what generation. So I'm sure that's really interesting on their end.
Yeah. When you think about the fact that, you know, Load passed its 20th anniversary.
That's crazy. Yeah. Cause to me, that's still like the newer record.
Right. Right.
But yeah, I mean, but when I do think about when that came out, you know, that was a long time ago, man. It's crazy.
And there's people who are 20 years old where it's like, you know.
It's crazy, yeah.
It's like, you know, early Black Sabbath or something to them would be to us.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating to me, that sort of the perspective that you gain. And, you know, as a journalist, that was something I really started to kind of hone in on, having had that. The different experience of being in a band once upon a time myself, and managing bands and being a journalist, you know, and I'm not going to name names, because this is nothing personal about this particular band, but it's an example of something I ran into a lot a few years back. Gosh, I guess 10 years ago at this point, I was on the road with a band doing a cover story, on them, and they were a very big band at that time, in that moment, in that Warped Tour, Hot Topic scene. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, their crowd was just, you know, an endless sea of teenage girls and guys in, like, you know, this was the era of, like, the Dayglow shirts with, like, a unicorn vomiting a rainbow into ice cream or whatever. Like, yeah, yeah. And they were just the kings of that scene, right? And really coming up. And I spent a week on the road with these guys doing this story. And all they wanted to talk about was how, you know, they were embarrassed, basically, that they had these, like, little kids as their fans. Mm-hmm. And that they weren't taken seriously as musicians or as a heavy band. And how their favorite bands were Converge and, like, all the, you know, all this cred stuff. Yeah. And they really wanted to, you know, their next record, they're really going to make a statement about this, that, and the other. And their goal, you know, one of the pull quotes in the story was one of the guys in the band said, I want fat, bearded, 30-year-old dudes drinking beer at our shows. And it was this whole thing, right? And there were just, so just endless conversations about it. So towards the end of the week that I was on the road with them, one of the guys in their crew, they had nicknamed him Throwdown. And at one point I was like, hey, so why do you call that guy Throwdown? And they were like, oh, because he's just, you know, he's just like this hilarious, like shitty, like mosh kid. Like his ringtone was this Throwdown song. And like whenever his phone rings, we all start moshing. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, you know, because I, you know, Dave Peters from Throwdown is my best friend. I was, you know, the best man in his wedding. And I've been the band's manager for years and years. And this kid from the band is like, oh, wow, dude, that's amazing. Yeah, I used to love those guys, man. I used to love all that Trustkill Records and Ferret and, you know, and bands like Throwdown and Terror and Madball and all that would, like, come to my town. I was super stoked. And then without any hint of irony or self-awareness, he says very sincerely, what happened to those guys, man? Like, they went all, like, metal. And that was, and I don't say this to call anyone out. It was kind of the first time that I really noticed, and then I started noticing it. You know, I started seeing it, band after band after band. I kept finding myself in those situations where there was like a real, you know, force for the trees.
And that's weird because that era, those bands, I never really saw them as, of, you know, they evolved, but I don't think their sound changed that much to be like, oh, I don't know.
But those fans, that's
pretty funny. Yeah, but yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, and then Throwdown went through so much evolution, and then did a kind of throwback record for the fans. Like, okay, this is what everybody's been asking for.
Yeah.
And then there was a contingent of the fans online who complained that it didn't sound like the record before it that was like, you know, had the hits on Octane. So,
and that's the thing. I mean, you can't win.
No, you can't. Which is why it's got to be, like you said, that that authenticity and that intention and that sort of purpose of doing what matters to you. Which I think,
yeah,
is the thing
and
that
I think even within bands, you get in these moments where you're trying to, like you said, that band was trying to analyze their fan base and, you know, the grass is always greener kind of idea. Like, yeah. I wish we had these. I mean, I think every band, you just, everyone has that, I think, because at the end of the day, you want to be cool. You want to have cred amongst your peers. You want your idols. You know, I want Tom York to listen to my records. But, you right. know, it's, you know, but I don't know. It's just one of those things. I guess you're either grounded or not. I don't know where I'm going with this.
No, you're right. I mean, and it's I always think about certain bands, like you said, you always, you know, at the height of Dashboard Confessional, you know, like mm-hmm. 2003, you know, gold and platinum records and MTV success and all this stuff. And I was doing a cover story. His whole camp at the time forbid me to use the word emo in my interview.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, and still to this day, what do you think about? You're like, oh, they were like the defining kings
of that,
you know, but, and again, it's not to throw Chris under the bus. He's a great guy, super talented artist, but he all he did the entire time he was king of that mountain was bristle against it and wish that people saw him how he saw himself and didn't pigeonhole him in this like scene that he's embarrassed by.
Yeah, and they and he wants people to like hear me now. Like this is what I'm doing now.
Yes,
but
yes.
But the time and place thing comes in play, and a lot of those people that was a those old songs were important in their lives, so that's what they care about. So
yeah, and
the, yeah, it's tough, man.
And the whole configuration was important, you know, because I remember when it was like, yeah, it's just him and an acoustic guitar and blah 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 blah, and then like suddenly he's got a band and he's working with like the Counting Crows producer and all those kids are like, what is this? This isn't one. And it's that same feeling I think of, like Jason Newsted kind of says in the Metallica Behind the Music Once Upon a Time. He's like, yeah, I understand that if you're holding a copy of the Black Album and you're like, this is my Metallica, and then you pick up this new album and like, here we are in like, you know, Cuban, like smoking Cuban cigars and these like pimp suits. You know, he's like, I get it. Yeah. You know, but on the flip side, I totally get what the band was trying to do in terms of aggressively sort of punk rock, like changing and evolving and saying, like, no, we're all kinds of different things. And then I think eventually they sort of, you know, I would argue they came back to themselves. I mean, I Hardwired, which I would definitely recommend to you. It's similar to Death Magnetic in the sense that it's aggressive and thrashy and metal and, you know, not like the 90s. But it's also, unlike Death Magnetic, there's a big return to the some of the vocal harmonies and the stuff that Hetfield was doing on the Black Album. And, yeah. And I actually really love the record because it's a nice blend of, you know, it's the thing every band says about their new record, but it really does kind of encompass all of the previous chapters,
everything to do, yeah,
kind of in a, in what, yeah. And dude, I'm gonna blow you up with my load reload playlist where I can distill it to the songs that you should care about that I bet might actually connect with you now that you may have dismissed.
I mean, it's then. Yeah, I mean, I can't remember. I mean, I probably haven't listened to any of that stuff since it came out.
Load has a top 10 all time Metallica song on it for me.
Really?
Okay.
How about that? Well, send it over. And I'll give it a chance.
And by the way, I set out to do this on every episode, and I think I've only done it once.
Mm-hmm.
What's kind of your top five Metallica if you had to break
songs
song wise? Yeah.
Songs is tough. It's more albums. I'm an album guy.
Well, but that's easy. Man. If I was like your top five, you'd be like the first five.
Well, yeah, top five. I mean. There's so many good songs. I mean, I think like the, you know, I remember growing up that those long instrumental songs were so important to me.
Yes.
And I looked forward to them because they normally did one on every album. I don't know. It's such a, I'd never heard anything like that. And now, I don't know. I think that's in some way influences a lot of things I do now.
Oh, and I love that, kind of, you know, album sequencing was such a lost art now. And mm-hmm. I love how the second, third, and fourth Metallica records, like, you know, all of them are, they're bookended by fast songs. The instrumental is kind of in the same place. The ballad's in the same place. The title track's in the same place. I loved that kind of meticulous planning that they would do. It was so cool.
Yeah, I mean, dude, top five songs is... I don't know if I can even do it, man. I mean, even looking here, they're all good, dude.
It's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah. I mean, dude, to kind of backtrack a second, I love the evolution of his voice. You know, as a singer, I think it's cool to hear, like, the definite punk influence of the early days, but he kind of found... I feel like Master of Puppets is... his vocal album for me, because it's kind of in between, I guess you would say, his newer style and his older style. It just had such a good tone.
It's interesting to me as someone, you know, how musical you are and the breadth of your, what you do, you know, what your fans know that you do. I'm surprised actually that you wouldn't say the Black Album vocal wise.
Yeah. Something about, because I like the rawness in his old style, and it's still there with Master of Puppets. You know, Master Puppets and Justice for All, it's pretty close for me vocally. I love his vocals on, you know, the Black Album, but there's not that rawness, the punk kid that he obviously had in him, I think, kind of shines a little more in those other albums, as well as his mature, like, I can sing voice. So I think that's why I think that.
Let me ask top you this five. instead of trying to paint you in a top five corner, how about this? When you put on a guitar,
mm-hmm.
and you're, you know, distracted, maybe you're watching a movie or you're, you know, sitting on the bus and somebody's talking to you or whatever, you know, with your family, whatever the case may be, what's your go-to, like if a Metallica riff is going to come out of your hands, what's the most common riffs that you're going to be just sitting around jamming?
I mean, Fade to Black for sure. It's always, you know, a few riffs in that song. Blackened is one of those. To this day, because I don't keep up with that stuff, you know, as far as guitar. So probably just, you know, One. I still remember a lot of One. I mean, One's up there for top songs, just as far as, you know, we're talking about the evolution of the band, and you know, I think that song is like at the very top of like creativity for me, in their sound. You know, I think One is such a good, you know, some of the hits on the Black Album aren't my favorite. You know, I love Of Wolf and Man.
I'm a big fan of Deep Cuts on the Black Album.
Yeah, I think that's such a good song.
Dude, God That Failed is,
yeah, The God That Failed. I feel like those songs, like, if I listen to that record, those songs stick out to me more than the usuals.
Well, and I think we're so familiar. I mean, that side A is like...
yeah, just, yeah. I mean, it's radio songs, you know. Yeah. So, Dyer's Eve always had a big impact on me.
That's a top 10 song for me, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so good. Master of Puppets, I mean, I think just the diversity in that song.
I feel like Puppets and...
I mean, Damaging
Death are maybe the two songs if, you know, aliens arrive and they're like, what is Metallica? You know, you'll get one shot. I feel like Puppets or Creeping Death would be one of those two songs that I would play and say, this is what Metallica is.
Yeah. I mean, for me, all those top songs are probably between Black Album and Justice for All and Master of Puppets. I mean, I love Ride the Lightning. But like I was saying earlier, like when you ask yourself, like, okay, here's my Metallica moment. What do I want to listen to? You know, I normally don't throw on those first two records, even though they're phenomenal. They're great records. But yeah. And as far as those instrumental songs, I think Call of Cthulhu, whatever, however you say that. I think that's one of the better ones.
They spelled Cthulhu wrong, so you're under no obligations.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah, which they laugh about now.
That's good to hear because we've all had those moments where you're like, exactly. Oh, we should have asked some people if that was right or not.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter creator, is having a moment like that right now where she's getting burned on social media because she named Voldemort's snake after a deity that she thought was from one part of the world that's actually from another part of the world.
Oh, crazy.
And she's being roasted for being culturally insensitive and this and that. And it's like, you know what? People fuck up.
Yeah.
Like, she created an entire fictional universe. Like, there's going to be some
God, there's going to be some loopholes here and there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well awesome, I didn't answer it in order of five, but those were a few.
No, we got there. I got it out of you. Yeah, and I would recommend... to everyone listening and to you as well, again, as a, you know, I don't mean to keep patting you on the back, but as someone who is as accomplished as you are, the box sets they've been doing since they got the rights to their masters back, they've been releasing one by one these just magnificent, insane box sets for each album. And Justice for All is next in the queue.
Oh, cool.
and they've done, you know, the first three albums, and they did one actually for the Garage Days EP too.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
But it's just, you know, aside from the fact that there's like a huge hardcover book with tons of photos and anecdotes and liners and all of that, and tons of live stuff. And
yeah, it's cool that they do all that. I mean, I remember even, I meant to talk about this earlier, the what was it, Live Shit, Binge and Purge thing?
Yeah.
I mean, that packaging, I remember just kind of being in awe of it, you know, even when I was younger.
Yeah.
You know, like the road case.
Oh, dude. I mean, for the fan club for years, they did
it was a thing phenomenal.
Called the Fan Can that was uh-huh. like a little paint bucket that you got in the mail, and it had just all this stuff in it. And some of it would just be like, here's a CD of them jamming on an Oasis song. Like just the most random, just like literally like the vaults.
And so what's so cool about that is, you know, we're this day and age, everybody's trying any and everything to be creative as far as stuff like that. Like, you know, making anyone care any shape or form. But it's so cool that they did all that at a point where they didn't need to do that.
Right.
You know, they were selling a shitload of records, making a shitload of money. You know, they didn't need to do that at all. And God, just remember, you know, the attention, the detail, you know, in particular that box, you know, the Live Shit, and it had the, you know, I think it had the VHS version. It had the different sets and, you know, I wore that stuff out, man. And it was just presented in such a way that it was kind of how people try to do things now, where they're like, please buy me. This is
right.
Look, it looks cool. There's, you know, it feels personal to you. You know, it feels you're hearing things that maybe
we wrote your name like in you here. Shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's cool to think about that at that era when bands didn't have to do that.
They put out B-sides that were demos of, you know, Hetfield going la, 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 you know, like,
I mean, I think they allowed that stuff to be exposed is pretty, you know, even that documentary that some kind of monster.
Very instructive. Like, well, I mean, dude, you're in a band. Is there a person?
Dude, I would never let, if somebody filmed and I saw that much being exposed, like, that can't release that. Like, are you kidding me? But I mean, it's they were like, eh, fuck it. It's what happened. It's who we are.
And so many people connected to it, of course, especially people who have been in a band at any sort of professional level.
Oh,
but also people that are in other types of creative relationships.
Yeah, I think any rut, you know, be it in any form of life, you know, I think you can relate to what they were going through. You know, it was relationships and them not meshing in that sense, and they weren't meshing musically. So yeah, and it's entertaining to boot. So
yeah, and it's that thing like a lot of bands where it's like, you know, imagine getting married to somebody at 15 because you had one thing in common.
Yeah,
and here you are. You know, you're 50, and you've been with this person more than anyone else in your life.
And it's cool for them to kind of expose, you know, the normies that is how it is too, because I think, you know, a lot of people, you don't really think about that. Like being in a band, you love the dudes, but you know, if you're in a long career, you're basically in this super close knit relationship with these other people.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with everything life throws at you together.
And no matter what you do to establish your own identity, whether that's a solo project or whatever, you're linked to them forever.
Yeah.
You know,
Very true.
I mean, Ace has done so much outside of Kiss, but of course half of our conversation the other night was about Kiss.
Yeah. You know? And obviously the diehards know it all, but I mean, there's the people that have no clue about that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Tommy, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. You were so,
thank you, man.
I wanted to get on here. So
thank you for having me. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah. And, where can people see you in the coming months? I know you guys are going to Europe, and
we're going to Europe.
Speaking of solo projects, you have a solo thing on the way.
Yeah, I have a new record coming out November. When are you putting this out?
Probably in the next couple weeks, before November for sure.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I have a new record coming out November 9th.
Two days after my birthday. Happy birthday to me.
There you go. So yeah, and then the band is we're touring in Europe in, I guess, first show is release date of my solo record. So
nice.
I'll be overseas for that. But yeah, got a lot going on. I'm excited for the world to hear what I'm doing and the band's doing. And yeah, who knows, man? We take one thing at a time. So we'll see what the upcoming years bring.
Well, dude, seriously, thanks again. And I know you're busy right now, so that it means all that much more that you took the time to do this. And
no worries, man. Thanks, man.
All right, thanks, brother.
You can find Tommy Rogers on Twitter at TommyBTBAM. That's Tommy, B-T-B-A-M. And keep up with everything between The Buried and Me and with Tommy's solo work. And he also does a great job of sharing what he's listening to on a, I think, daily basis. You can keep up with Speak and Destroy on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where we are often posting all sorts of visual Metallica treats, the results of many years of obsessive fandom and deep dive searching. We get into more detail about our guests and some of the topics discussed over at speakanddestroy.com. And of course, please subscribe, leave us a 5-star rating, leave us a nice review, and check out past episodes with great guests like M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, Rob Flynn of Machine Head, Lizzie Hale of Hailstorm, Blasco of Ozzy Osbourne's band, Gary Holt of Exodus and Slayer, Alex Skolnick of Testament, and many, many more. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.